This is KBOO's The Voice of the Middle East. صوت الشرق الأوسط من إذاعة كيبو و صدای خبرمیانه از رادیو KBOO.
طلوا حبابنا طلوا نسيب يا ولد بين ربوعنا خلوا تحت الزهرات الوالي وطلوا حبابنا طلوا نسيب يا ولد وبين ربوعنا خلوا تحت الزهرات الوالي وعلى مياه لقينا على أقصى ما خلوا زاد الطير الشاد نحن حكايات في بال مننا المات موال نحن حكايات
صلى صلى
طوب نحن حكايات في بال مننا المات موال
نحن حكايات في بال مننا المات موال
لما نسمات نحلاله بين الغابات بلاد لما نسمات بلاد بين الغابات بلاد طلوا حبابنا طلوا نسهم يا
Back to Voices of the Middle East. This is Gudar Zakhtadari, your host. I had a chance to come back again within 2 weeks after our previous show on 29th, and this is actually an interesting time. Again, we are still continuing to work on our goals for Pledge Drive. Unfortunately, we didn't meet the goal in time frame that station had set, so they have extended for another 3 days. And what I like to ask all the listeners is to really go to their phone and have their checkbooks ready and credit cards and what have you, and make sure that we make this thing happen. My understanding is that we are still about $8,000 to $10,000 below the goal, and although we have done pretty good in the past couple of days, but still 2 more days to go, and we need support from all the listeners, and we actually need all the support that we can get, especially my show. If you remember two shows ago, basically, it was a month ago, I talked to a representative of a Kurdish regional government in Iraq, and that interview probably would have not happened if we didn't have a cable station here. And kind of the information that we get from the field and in the Middle East is not possible unless you support the radio station that provides this airtime to our program and to the people of our region to be heard in the United States and in Oregon. As I said, we talked to Nijar Shamdan a month ago, and the last week the election in assembly in Iraq finally appointed a president who is Kurd. And he's the first non-Arab president in the Arab world. And in my opinion, that's not really a bad thing. It's the first time that Kurds have established themselves in the region as a voice that cannot be neglected. Almost 20 million people are living in northern Iraq, in west northwest of Iran, and southwest of Turkey, southeast of Turkey. And they have never had a government for themselves. And this is the first time that a president of an Arab country is non-Arab and is Kurd. So, if that's a good thing, then let's hope for the future. Although we are not very optimistic about the really sustainability of these changes. Kind of gave you heads up that we're going to have a very fabulous interview tonight and very beautiful guest who has come all the way from not just North Carolina, but also far east. She has been in Palestine for 6 years, and my guest is Ellen O'Grady. Welcome to the show, Ellen.
Thank you. It's very good to be here.
Couple weeks ago, I was contacted by Friends of Seville folks in Portland, and they kind of wanted to let me know that Ellen is coming here, and she's a writer and an artist and a social justice activist. And I'd like to ask you first to maybe talk about yourself a little bit. How did you get involved with going to Palestine, and what basically attracted you to continue staying there for a long period of time?
I was a religious studies major for my first undergraduate, and I was actually headed to Nepal. I was very interested in Eastern theology and Eastern thought. It was about 2 months before I was supposed to head to Nepal, and there was a very minor travel advisory out for U.S. citizens. My parents were not too excited about my interest in Nepal, so they asked me to consider another location, a safer location. And this was in 1988, of course, during the first Palestinian uprising, the first Intifada. And so I thought about it, and my second choice was Jerusalem. But then I considered that Jerusalem was basically front page news. Palestine and Israel was front page news, the clashes between soldiers and youth, Palestinian youth. So Jerusalem became somewhat of a trap. I thought if I said Jerusalem, then Nepal would start looking good. But my parents thought that that Jerusalem sounded lovely. So that's how I ended up going. I knew very little before I left. I have to admit, before I boarded the plane, I hardly knew where Palestine was in relationship to Israel, where the West Bank and Gaza were. But then I would, a couple of weeks after I arrived, would find myself in the middle of the West Bank, what seemed to me to be in the middle of the Intifada.
And that was after college or just
that
high
was,
school?
No, that was for a semester in college. That was in 1989, spring semester. So that was the first, that was my introduction.
Okay. And then you, how did you decide to stay and then go back again?
I think in those 3 months, I realized I had a small taste of what the occupation was. And I started hearing stories and meeting people, hearing their stories that I had never heard before, stories of Palestinians living in the West Bank and Gaza. And I also had a deeper understanding of U.S. involvement in the area. One of the first stories in my book involves two kids that I met in Bethlehem in 1989. I was going to Bethlehem every Tuesday, and I would meet these kids every time I went in there, and there were about eight of them, and the two that I knew the best were, they're both 8 years old, Ali and Mahmoud. And every time I would go in, you know, they would be excited to see me. I would practice my Arabic. They would practice their English. There was one week that I couldn't get in because there had been a clash between Israeli soldiers and Palestinian youth in which three Palestinians were killed. And so they closed Bethlehem, so no one could exit or enter. Several days later, I was able to enter. And when I got to Manger Square, I saw my young friends, and they were very agitated and wanted to let me know what had happened during the clash. So they pantomimed the whole thing. They acted out the chanting, the throwing of stones toward the soldiers, and then acted out running away, you know, like they had wings, like they were too fast for bullets. And then a couple of the kids fell to the ground acting like they had been shot. And Ali, who was sort of the ringleader of the group, his friend Mahmoud was always a step behind him. Ali pulled on my shoulder and pointed to one of the actors and told me that Mahmoud was dead, that his friend had been killed. So we sat together for a while, and I after a while, I got up to go, and again, he pulled on my sleeve, and he reached into his pocket and pulled out a bullet canister. And he said in Arabic, "Ilik, this is for you." I didn't understand then why he was giving me the canister, but I thanked him, and I started to leave. Again, he pulled on my arm, and he opened my fingers that were curled around the canister, and he pointed to the raised letters on the side, and it was written, "Made in Salzburg, Pennsylvania." So I think until that moment, I knew in my head about U.S. involvement over there, but holding the canister in my hand, having the weight of it in my hand, and standing next to Ali, and it just sunk really deep, and I felt the weight of that, and knew I wanted to return to better educate myself so that I could share the stories here.
And you mentioned in between of these emotional, I guess, narration of that story that in your book, and we want to let everybody know that you are on your book tour right now, and I have a schedule for a book reading tomorrow at Laughing Horse Books at 7 o'clock, and then on 16th on Saturday at Fort Vancouver Regional Library at noon until 2 p.m. Then on 17 at Southminster Presbyterian Church at 9 o'clock. This is in Denny Road in Beaverton. And on 18th at Willamette University in Salem at 7 p.m. We will repeat this information again. Can you talk a little bit more about... you decided to educate yourself and then go back again and try to help. How did you approach that?
I immediately returned as soon as I could. I returned that year working with a group called Middle East Witness, which is similar to Witness for Peace in Central America. I was placed in Gaza to be what they called a citizen diplomat, where I observed the situation in Gaza City, as well as teaching English at the Red Crescent Society. I would then return after a year, and this was 1991, so during the Gulf War, and I would return to the United States after that to go on a speaking tour, and then again returned immediately after to work with an educational organization. And I had about 3 or 4 different jobs in those 6 years. I ended up my last 2 years teaching art and implementing 2 art programs in a deaf school in Gaza and a school in Ramallah. And then that time ended in 1995. And then I returned in 2002 with the International Solidarity Movement. And it was after that trip that I started this, the paintings and stories that make up this book.
Okay, your first trip was during the Intifada, the first Intifada. And then the second one was after Oslo Peace Accord. And obviously there were some differences as far as possibilities for Palestinian government and like schools. And what was the, I mean, how does the thing evolved until now? Can you tell us a little story of the lifestyle basically in Palestine? You mentioned not very many people in the U.S. know about what does it mean to be under occupation and what is the life looking.
Well, in the book is primarily stories from 2002. So this is after the Israeli invasion into the West Bank in the spring of 2002. I spend most of my time in a village called Arak Borin, right outside of Nablus, and spend much of that time walking with Palestinians in need of health care. At that time, all towns and villages, cities, are under closure, which means that no one's allowed to exit or enter those cities for school, for work, for medical care. So in 2000, in that summer, I was trying to help Palestinians in need of medical care leave Iraq Barin to go to Nablus to help them cross the border, cross the checkpoint. So this would mean you're usually talking with Israeli soldiers and trying to negotiate, trying to get people in. You know, and I say try to help. I don't know that my presence was always helpful. I think sometimes it was. Sometimes I think perhaps seeing an international only made the soldiers perhaps more angry. But I think for the most part it was and at that time more helpful. So just to give a description of what life was like, I think most things that we take for granted here, you cannot take for granted there, such as being able to get to school, being able to get to work, getting to health care. One of the stories in my book talks about a woman that I met who was pregnant when I met her, and she had a very late pregnancy. The baby was very large. She went into labor at night, and the baby could not be delivered vaginally. She couldn't get to the hospital because of the closure, and her baby died in labor. And this is not uncommon. I tell another story about a woman with diabetes who was suffering because she couldn't receive her medication. There was no clinic, no hospital in her village, and because of the closure, she couldn't get to the hospital in Nablus. So it's unfortunately, it's only gotten worse since that time, since I've last been.
And you also consider yourself a painter. When I looked at your book, there are many images that you have perceived and drawn. Can you talk about those a little bit?
Sure. I consider myself primarily a painter more than a writer. The book's made up of 22 paintings, which I will be presenting at the different events this weekend through a slideshow storytelling presentation. The painting, while I was there, I painted people's portraits. Those were watercolor portraits. So while they told me their stories, I would often paint them. When I returned to the United States, I started the paintings which make up this book, which are large. Most of these paintings are about four feet in width. And what else can I say about them? Come to the event.
Part of the story, the painting, or
yes.
You say you draw them here. You paint
them
here.
Yes, I painted them here. When I returned in 2002, I had a very exact idea about what sort of presentation I was supposed to be giving. And it was a very academic approach, a very academic presentation with numbers and statistics. And I tried to write that and I couldn't. I was utterly depressed after being there that summer. So I started just writing a story for myself, writing the story that I needed to write to get through my depression. And at the same time started painting the stories. And in the beginning, the paintings and the stories existed separately, and then I realized that they were coming together. The paintings involve a childhood story about how, as a kid, I sort of recognized that there are stories that we don't hear, that there are stories that are hidden. The book is called Outside the Ark, which refers to Noah's Ark. Mm-hmm. And you know, we hear the story about the rainbow, but we don't hear the story about the people and the animals who died in the flood. And as a child, I recognize that in the stories in the book.
Okay, do you want to talk a little bit more about the book? And let me give the schedule one more time. Tomorrow night at 7 o'clock, Alan would be at Laughing Horse Book at 3652 Southeast Division in Portland. And then it would be presentation and book signing. As she mentioned, there's going to be a slideshow of this painting of the book and then reading of the book, the story. And on April 16th, Fort Vancouver Regional Library at noon. This is located on East Mill Plain Boulevard in Vancouver at 1007 East Mill Plain. And then on 17th, it's at Southminster Presbyterian Church. It's in 12250 Southwest Denny Road, corner of Denny and Hall in Beaverton, Oregon, at 9 o'clock. The last event in Oregon is in Salem at Willamette University at 7 o'clock, Mark O. Hatfield Library at Hot Hatfield Room at 7 o'clock. But again, please make sure you give a call to the station and pledge your support. And if you have any question for Ellen, you can call the air room, which is 231-8187, 503-231-8187. Our lines are open. Fortunately, the air room, and unfortunately, the pledge center. So please make a call. And back to Len. She promised me to read something from the book.
Oh, okay.
So do you
want
to read now, or you want to talk about it first?
Sure. Well, first, I just wanted to mention about this tour. One of the hopes is that in putting this book together in the form of paintings and stories, that we might be able to reach audiences that may not go to a lecture. So I've been trying to get into high schools and colleges, art departments, and it's been very fulfilling for me because a number of professors have been using the book with their classes and with classes in which the students are telling their own stories and their own stories that often aren't heard in the society. So it's been great to hear stories behind stories that aren't necessarily related to Palestine, but where students draw parallels. So that's been really exciting. I shared several stories about people who were Palestinians living in the West Bank, who, because of the closure, are unable to get to medical care. I'm going to share part of a story, and all these stories are connected to paintings, and this particular painting is one that is a favorite for many, I think because it expresses some hope. So the painting itself is of a room in Asghar refugee camp, and the bottom half of the painting is very dark, and it shows four people sleeping, three on the floor, one elderly woman in a bed. And then from one of the girls' heads is sort of a something of a bubble that shows what she's dreaming. And there's the tops of the dream opens up to a sunny sky, and it's the kids flying kites, and the kites are actually pulling them off the ground, and they're flying above the camp. So this is part of this family that I was living with for a week in Asghar refugee camp in Nablus. Their home is slated for demolition by the Israeli army. So the family doesn't know when the soldiers will come. It could be that night. It could be a night next week. It could be a night 6 months from now. But they know that the home is planned to be destroyed. So the organization that I was working with placed internationals in the homes with the hope that soldiers wouldn't come. Or at the very least, if the soldiers came, then the international might be able to negotiate with the soldiers to buy time for the family to gather their belongings before the home is destroyed. So I'll read a bit from the book. One of the girls that I stayed with, she was nine, her name is Asil. Asil tells me that she sleeps better when I'm there. It's usually very hard for her to sleep. She dreams the soldiers are coming to destroy their home. I ask her if she ever has good dreams. She thinks for a few moments before telling me that no, she does not remember any good dreams. 2 days later, while we are eating our breakfast of bread and hummus, Asil tells me excitedly that yes, she's had a good dream. We are under curfew. I am flying my kite out the window, and a strong wind comes and pulls hard on the kite. The wind pulls and pulls the kite and then pulls me out of the house and out over the camp. I am scared at first, but then I see other children flying with their kites, and I'm not scared anymore. I laugh. It's a wonderful feeling to fly. When the Israeli army puts an area under curfew, it is like being under 24-hour house arrest. There's no going out of the house at all without risk of being shot. The curfew can last days and weeks at a time. To pass the time, children often fly kites out their top floor windows. If you look out, you can see many kites. It is both play and defiance.
Well, thank you very much for reading that. I guess you can tell the story yourself of different things that are in the book and you experience yourself, and that's why you went back each time to be with them, basically. What do you see when you are on these trips and reading books and showing your paintings? What kind of audience are coming, and how do they respond to these stories?
Well, the audiences are very varied, which is what I had planned in the beginning. So I'm going to churches, I'm going to Jewish centers, I'm going to schools, including high schools and middle schools. So many times people know a lot about this subject, often not so much. And so, again, the response is varied. I would say that overall people are grateful to hear stories that we don't hear in our media. And again, it's been incredible also to hear other people's stories. So like I've gone to some very poor schools in New Orleans, some middle schools and high schools, and to hear the kids in those schools draw comparisons from their lives. So they might say, well, I can relate to what it is to be a Palestinian kid because I don't feel the security. I don't feel secure in my home. I don't feel that my parents or my mother can protect me. And that one kid told a story about how cops enter her home looking for someone and someone who wasn't there and harassed her mom. And just that sense of everyday insecurity. So that it's been really rich to hear stories from other people as they hear these stories.
I guess a year ago, there was a group of Palestinian, youth and children who came, and they were doing some dances, a group called Ibda. Mm-hmm. And I interviewed them, and they were, very very bright, mm-hmm. Despite all the difficulties that they're living in. They knew the world, they knew what they wanted, and I think I saw a kind of commitment to life in the next generation of Palestinian, more so than you can see here, even in our kids, and our children are so kind of passive to what is happening in their surrounding, as opposed to folks who are really under difficulties and under pressure. They don't take it, as you mentioned before, they don't take it as granted, the same way we do. How do you, you said you were teaching there to kids too. Mm-hmm. How did you see the kids in Palestine?
Those last 2 years were definitely my favorite years when I was able to work with kids. And it was, a very diverse group of kids. I was working with at a Quaker school on the West Bank, and some of those kids were actually English speaking. I mean, they spoke Arabic, but they were raised in the United States and then returned to Palestine for high school. And then I worked with deaf kids in Gaza. Sort of what you were referring to. I mean, these kids have seen so much, and it was very hard for me to relate to their lives because my childhood was so different. I told the story in the beginning about the kid who saw his best friend killed at 8 years old, and having the knowledge that the United States was involved in the occupation and the killing of his friend, and the knowledge that I was from the United States. And while he saw me as a friend, he also recognized that I had a responsibility. So sort of that sophistication is really remarkable.
But at the same time, they didn't take you accountable.
No, they weren't angry at me, and yet they, it was clear. I mean, it was only love between us, but it was, he also pointed out to me that there was a responsibility.
Made in U.S.
I read a wonderful article yesterday about kids in Gaza who are putting, with the help of a psychologist, putting together a book for kids in other war-torn areas, sort of how to cope under military attack, and So they had quotes from the kids saying, you know, how they were able to get through by making up games by that would make them laugh. If you see someone who looks sad, talk to them, and just pretty remarkable.
Well, thank you, Len. I guess we're getting close to the end of the show tonight, and we need to go out to Pledge Drive one more time. And I would like to really thank you very much for coming to the studio tonight, and hope that the listeners will go to these events. Again, I repeat them one more time. Tomorrow night at 7 o'clock would be at Laughing Horse Books. Len would read from her book and show the and a slideshow of the paintings from the book, which are very, very interesting and very inspiring, actually, to see people like Len going there and do their best, not like the rest of us who are either closing their eyes to what is happening around them or they're not getting involved. There are people like Len O'Grady who really take their life in hand. We haven't forgotten Rachel Corey and her destiny in Palestine. So it's really appreciating your efforts and going around and sharing your stories with the people. And I'm hoping that those who are coming to these book readings and book tours and lecture tours basically will connect with you and your emotions and would understand what is happening there and how they can help. Appreciate it very much for coming tonight.
Someday